welcome you to this week's episode of the Morningstar Men's Ministry Podcast. We're in the fifth of a six-part series entitled Every Father Needs to Know. This week we're looking at the topic, or the title of the topic, I should say, is Understanding Failure. There's a lot of great material that's going to be discussed in the course of the morning. There's even more material available in study notes. If any of you are interested, please reach out to the men's ministry and you can obtain that. However, the material is going to bounce around quite a little bit, so it might take some effort to follow and track with it because there's sort of a live group interaction that takes place. However, if you listen thoughtfully, maybe even break it up and listen over a couple of sessions, a couple of sittings, or maybe several commutes if you listen to this while you drive, I'm pretty sure you're going to get some really great stuff out of it. The challenge, of course, as I remind our men on Saturday mornings, is not just to take this in for yourself, and for many, some of the understandings are going to be revolutionary, but the bigger challenge is, how do we understand this and then make it applicable to our children? How do we, in fact, help our children to understand this? Because that really is the end goal that we have with this Every Father series. How do we equip and instill in our children the understandings that are going to make them launch-worthy adults? So I hope this is a blessing to you. Look forward to catching up with you again next week. Again, let me remind you, it's something I've said a few times. Don't get lost in the material for your own purposes. Our mission here is to be able to understand this in such a way as we can share it with children and grandchildren. Now, that doesn't mean it's not good for us to review the material, but we need to have in mind, as we're learning this material, how can I help others to appreciate and understand this? At the top of your first page, as a matter of fact, filling most of your first page, are a collection of quotes on failure. But before we get into them, I'd like to point out the obvious. I selected these quotes from among hundreds, each because they said something about failure that was a little unique or a little different. Now, here's my thought on this. How many of you, at the moment when you are in the pits and you are in the midst of failure, feel particularly insightful and wise? And so nobody is philosophically profound and wants to offer brilliant statements about failure when they're in the middle of failing. Just keep that in mind. And so therefore, what we have to conclude is, if there are literally hundreds and hundreds of observations made by individuals about failure, they're probably all made on the other side of failure. And as a matter of fact, you're going to see that in a moment. So what's the takeaway from that right there? You're not alone when you fail, and there is hope for you if you are in the middle of this, because there are countless stories of people who have failed, sometimes in very big ways, and gotten to the other side of it. The problem is, there's that season in the middle when we feel hopeless. All right, so here's a couple of them. Did you want to say? Go ahead. Knowledge, understanding.
Or understanding. And you'll do it differently next time.
Now keep in mind, Jim, as you say this, there seems to be a little gray in your beard there, which means you've lived for more than a few years, and you've acquired the perspectives that come from a man who has lived for more than a few years.
And failed more than a few times.
And your children and grandchildren have lived less years. They have less perspective, and therefore for them, they don't have the perspective of, well, I went through this 5-year bad patch of life, but then there was good on the other side of it. For them, 30 minutes of trauma is a big deal.
And do you impart that wisdom as well as our fathers did? Like sitting around the table, hey, you know, man, I really screwed up today, or man,
what a week it was, and sit around the table and you talk about your failures? Or do we not, or is that taboo?
Well, we're going to, well, let's, give me enough time to at least get into this before. All right. So where were we? If you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. So let's just think about that. What's being said there?
If you're afraid to be wrong, you'll never try.
And if you want to rely on current thinking and current understanding, you're never going to posit anything new. You're never going to put anything new out there. How's the world working these days? All the best ideas that we have contributed to the world being the way it is right now. And therefore, we might conclude, even safely so, that we need more and better ideas than some of the ones that we have right now, because it seems that the world is the way that it is because of the thinking that we have right now. Yet, we're reluctant to put out there new ideas. And why is that?
Requires risk.
Requires risk. There's fear.
But what's the risk? Risk of humiliation, risk of failure, risk of criticism.
Criticism and humiliation. There is emotional attachment. If I value an idea, it's my idea, and if I put it out there, my reputation is at stake. And, yes, John?
You know, it's two real quick things. This quote by Ken Robinson, I listen to him a lot, and for any of you guys that have young kids, you need to go on YouTube and listen to this guy about developing your skills where the schools don't recognize it. Number two, just completely slipped my mind. But this guy...
That's also a result of having gray in your beard. Anyway, go on.
Thank you. But Ken Robinson is a great guy to listen to. He's just a very, very smart guy. Lives in the United States now, originally from England. But he is one sharp dude. And he's just great to listen to, especially where your kids.
All right, now, the next thing I want to do, the next quote we're going to look at, I want you to be discerning here. Maybe the name Dennis Waitley doesn't mean anything to you, but for a season, about 10, 15, 20 years ago, he was really well known. Okay, failure should be our teacher, not our undertaker. Failure is delay, not defeat. It is temporary. It is a temporary detour, not a dead end. Failure is something we can avoid only by saying nothing, doing nothing, and believing nothing. Doesn't that sound polished? Do you think that's a rehearsed line? I think it is. The words rhyme, it's smooth, it's slick, it's nice. And so somebody can look at that and say, well, that's a great motivational speech, but does it sound as if he has any experience with that? Now let's look at the next one, because we know this next guy a little bit better. Success is not final. Well, that's interesting. Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is only the courage to continue that counts. And look at who said that. Well, now that guy we know went through a few difficulties. So when we look at that, notice this. The words don't rhyme all that much. He doesn't go on and on. He just makes a simple, pithy statement. But because we know the man's life, we can take stock in that.
Hey, Glenn, here's another guy. Never really reconciled with his father. When he was young, his father sent him away to boarding school, yep, in Churchill, and hardly talk about the father thing that we were talking about the last couple of weeks and everything. A leader and a dad. Winston Churchill's father couldn't have cared less about this kid. He was a real jerk. And that was probably, a lot of people say that was responsible for Winston Churchill developing his character and his attitude the way he did, because he always wanted to be better. He always wanted to try and prove something. And it was only in the later years that he sort of halfway reconciled with his dad.
Well, now, John, I'm so sure that's a good message to be telling fathers here. Because what you're almost implying is that if I'm a detached father that's hypercritical, then my kids will grow up with better character.
Well,
it's a great story, but I'm not sure we want to draw that conclusion from there.
Well, he was wrong to be a jerk, but that's what I got this morning. There's not just a bigger risk of being wrong, there's a bigger risk than we have to commit to doing the work. If you're going to a church or to somebody with a great idea and they're like, okay, now how are you going to implement that? And I thought, crap, I couldn't do that part. We so often throw great ideas out there and aren't willing to commit to doing the work it takes to get them rolling.
Yeah, that's certainly true. All right. I'd rather be partly great than entirely useless. Now that's pretty profound. So I gave a little bit of thought to that last night again in preparing for this. And how much of what we do, are we simply doing what has been done safely numerous times before? And again, drawing the conclusion that the world needs different ideas, better ideas, different work, not the same work. What does it take to try something new and different? There's a profound risk at that. No human ever became interesting by not failing. The more you fail and recover and improve, the better you are as a person. Now, I just read through that very fast, but look at that process. The more that you fail and then recover and then improve, the better you are as a person. Ever meet someone who's always had everything work out for them with few struggles? They usually have the depth of a puddle. But isn't that true? And they're usually the ones with the Dennis Waitley length maxims to share with you about how your troubles will just go away, and they have a quote to offer you. And yet, the people who have been through the most often have a few words, but the words are a little bit more profound. All right, with that in mind, let's jump back over now to this first sheet that I gave you, the single sheet, and let's define failure. So without looking at the page, give me an operating definition of failure. What are the components of failure? And I don't want a simple definition. I want something that's complex enough that we can dig into. What?
A goal.
Failure is a...
You have to have a goal.
Okay. So one of the components of failure involves a goal, we'll say. I'm just writing ideas up here. We'll organize them later.
Not meeting that specific goal.
Okay, not meeting the goal. Anything else?
Say not reaching expectations. Say not reaching the outcome that you had.
Okay.
You know what's funny about that? When this failure started, you're writing all this stuff down. At what point in this does failure start?
Are you asking a question or setting us up to answer the question?
Kind of both.
Okay, well, that's a great setup, Brother Jim. Would you like to answer your own question or not?
If I'm still trying to meet my goal and reaching, and I still intend to reach my outcome, I still intend to do that. Maybe I slow it down, maybe I need to stop. But you know what? I'm not giving up on this. It's going to happen. I'm still believing for good things. Maybe even if I have to lateral to someone else. You've all seen those plays in football. They never gave up. There were three laterals, and I finally got the end zone. Failure was not an option. At least kept trying. And trying. You know what I mean? And oftentimes, even in a football game, you say, man, they gave up. If they took the field at 41-0, they didn't give up. They just got beat.
So mindset. Failure is quitting.
All right. So now let's look at the definition. Failure can be described as missing or not satisfactorily achieving an intended and desired result when a serious attempt has been made to attain the result. And then there's several components. There can be no failure, there's his point, without a goal or an aim or objective. The objective has to be clear enough so that you can, there's not enough wiggle room that you can say, well, it wasn't quite this. So there has to be a clearly defined objective, a clearly defined outcome. There must have been a real attempt made to achieve the objective. And finally, there has to be something really important. In other words, it has to matter. So do you consider it a failure to burn the toast?
Yes, if you want to eat blue toast.
You're
tough, man.
Is it a failure or is it just a mistake?
Did my wife ask me for the toast?
Why do you always have to complicate things?
We're talking about family and children. And actually, if your four-year-old asks you for toast and you burn it, it is a failure.
Okay.
Dad, you burned the toast!
My point is that there has to be some emotional attachment to it. There has to be something significant to it. Or it really just doesn't matter. Remember what we talked about in work, and this is why I like to be able to tie all these things together. What did we say the difference between work and play was, if you were here that week? Anybody remember?
Play
One's fun, one's not.
Well,
work is to pay the bills. Fun was, didn't have to have.
There's no specific outcome for fun.
There we go. When I work, even if I love the work all day long, there is a specific and intended outcome that I have in mind. I don't do it solely for the joy of doing it. I do it hopefully with some joy, but because I have an intended outcome. When I play, outcome is less important. I may be very competitive, but still, it doesn't matter. The outcome is not the chief aim. The participation is the chief aim. So that's what separates play from work. So think about how work and the importance of something here, how we're going to define failure, are connected. Okay, so those four components, we'd ask our, and help your children to walk through that. If you have children or did have children at home, or you have children that live 1,000 miles away and you're still sort of like subsidizing them, there might be people here in the room who understand that. If that were true for you, can we ask these particular questions? Did I lack important knowledge which prevented a better outcome? So let me introduce two stories here. Now, one's a serious story, one's a silly story, but we've got to set this up so that you feel it. So the first story is this. There's the opportunity to give a presentation at your company. There might be 500 or 1,000 people present, or maybe it's a sales presentation to a client that's going to be a prospective large customer. And you're selected, or you volunteer, to give this important presentation. And you bomb at it. All right, so just feel the weight of that. You volunteer, you say you're the man, you take the responsibility, and you personally do a bad job, and you know you do a bad job, and it's not just your impression, but other people help you to understand that you did a bad job. Now here's the other one. You and your wife go to a carnival, and you have a few friends with you that night, and there's one of those little booths set up there where you throw a baseball and you knock some stuff over, and the guy baits you and challenges you, and it looks so simple, and you think, well, my word, how can anybody miss from this distance? It must be easy. And there in front of the guy who's challenged you, your wife who you're trying to impress, and all of your friends who are kind of like ribbing you a little bit, you fail miserably. All right? One's important, one's not so important. But let's think about those two scenarios as we walk through this. Did I lack important knowledge which prevented a better outcome? Did I lack important skills which were either completely missing or at least underdeveloped due to a lack of practice? So let's think about the presentation for a moment, and let's think about throwing the ball. Was there practice needed? Absolutely. Are there times, have you ever rushed into doing something and then later made the excuse, well, I didn't really have the time to prepare well for it? If I would have had more time, I would have done a better job. Have you ever used that as a cover screen because you really were scared to do, yeah, you could bring me a little bit more, that would be nice. Honestly, have you ever avoided the preparation because if you brought your best to something and failed then, it would really hurt. But if you didn't try your hardest in advance and you failed, then you always had that kind of way to ease your way out of it and say, well, I really didn't do everything I could have. Nobody else knows what I'm talking about there? Thanks. I'll catch up with you later. Did I lack the poise or the character necessary? But to me, this is a huge one. So imagine, let's say, in either case, you can feel this. Did I lack the poise that was necessary to succeed? So what does poise look like when 12 people are watching you throw a baseball at some trinket sitting there? Okay, he fails gracefully. We're looking right now at tries intensely. before we get to the failure. In other words, did I possess the poise in the moment to execute well? Let's think about the speaker. Can you think of a way in which poise is necessary and character is necessary in the moment when you're the speaker? Absolutely.
Whereas in the moment of 500 people watching, there's a little bit of a difference there. Like, and sometimes it happens to me when I first started hunting. I could hit a bullseye at 100 yards, no problem. But yet a deer walks in front of me and I'm in the woods and I'm like, holy crap, like there's, well, you know, and it's like,
That's the difference. It's the adrenaline. And like, chemically, we're ready for it. Chemically, our bodies are ready for that thing, whatever it is, whether it's baseball or the speech. Chemically, we're getting ready for it. And so what happens? Well, sometimes that thing runs down. I mean, if we can learn to just calm down, and I know you're talking to the scripture. It says relax. God's in control. 500,000, 5,000 people. Doesn't matter. Relax. Keep control of yourself. Now go ahead and talk. Well, or the baseball guy. Relax. It doesn't really matter. No one's going to die here today. Just go home. Did you ever hear a coach in baseball just say, you guys just go have fun? Stop trying to hit home runs. Mm-hmm. Just go connect with the ball and pass the ball. I don't know. Two different things.
The deer illustration was really good. So what is it about us in the moment that... And what's the common phrase that we use? He choked. What is it in the moment when... Exactly like you said, you stand in front of the bathroom mirror and you could give that presentation flawlessly. And as soon as there's 10 people in the room...
The reverse of that is over the mirror. I've done multiple presentations where I've over the mirror and you can score three, so over preparation is not as natural as well. So there comes a point where it has to be just natural.
And remember, this is not just a diagnostic for us. This is something that we're going to sit with a son or a daughter with and help them to look at a performance of their own. And they won't have the perspective of 40 or 50 years of living when they look at it. And so for them, it is a lot more traumatic. Was I given or did I allow adequate time for the effort? Now this is particularly important. Have you ever volunteered to do something that someone else gave you and not clearly thought through the timeline till delivery until after you said yes? Like, have you ever over-volunteered? Am I the only one who says I'll do too much and then later on regrets it?
Well, you know what, too? When you're thinking about that, for me, I know that people are all really different. Don't tell me I have all day to do it. Tell me I have an hour. And I'm better. I think better like this. You give me all day to do it and research and blah, 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 blah. I'm going to sit down and do zero. I really kind of need to be under a little bit of pressure to be able to think clearly and quickly and come up with like fresh original ideas. Because I'm, you know what I mean? Like I'm trying to... But if I'm given... It's just an interesting way to make that phrase. Were you given adequate time? Well, maybe I was given a little too much time.
Okay. But it's a critical thing that we need to help our kids understand. You see, and we're going to talk about this through these two lenses that we're going to look at in a minute. Lens one, interpretation of failure, which is the public education system model of failure. And lens two, which is a more business-oriented look at failure. And in lens one failure, it's always assumed that adequate time has been assigned to do whatever is necessary. And therefore, it's always assumed that time was somehow misused when there is a failure. Studying wasn't done in a timely way. This wasn't done. The work wasn't prepared for in advance. And sometimes that's true, right? We've all been parents to a son or a daughter has waited until the night before something is due. And then you ask the question, well, how long have you known about this? Only to find out that they've known about it for 2 months. Here's another one. Did I neglect resources which might have been available to me had I been willing to seek them or ask for help? So I'm in the middle of reading a book on leadership written by a couple of Navy SEALs, and the one guy tells this story. Now, they're no longer SEALs. They're out in corporate training right now. Their time of service is done. But they're using some of these stories to illustrate principles. And he says, they're in the middle of a very difficult situation in Iraq. The city is predominantly held by insurgents. There's just a few square blocks of it where the U.S. has an outpost. That's it. And they're trying to retake the whole city, literally street by street and block by block. So on this particular day, they take two groups. They send them out on patrol. Their job is to, house by house, door by door, enter, see who's there, make sure that it's secure, and move on. And they each have a certain amount of real estate that they're assigned to. Group 1's real estate is relatively close to the outpost that they have. Group 2's assignment is a little bit further out. They each go through the process with very little resistance. They check the areas that they're assigned to, and they're clear. But in the process of doing that, each of them essentially makes enough noise, causes enough locals to scream and cry in shock and whatever because they're startled, that they realize that they've now alerted the enemy. Group 1 is very close to being able to get back to their compound. Group 2, not so much. And so Group 2 has a decision to make. Do we try to get back on our own? Do we ask for support help? Or do we even bring in air cover to get back? Because they really are at this point in fear for what's going to happen. They decide to go back on their own. And so they do encounter significant, firepower from the enemy, we'll call it. And their strategy is to use a leapfrog method to get back. So they split the patrol in half. One group provides cover fire while the group leapfrogs behind them. And they leapfrog behind each other all the way back. They make it back to the outpost, to the compound, at which point they're meted not by congratulations, but rather by a reprimand saying, you took the wrong course of action, and in that process, you put at risk the lives of everyone in your patrol. And the guy says, what are you talking about? Now, he's expecting he did a phenomenal job, and he says, the other group was right there and ready to help. They were expecting the call for help. And instead of getting the call for help from you, you decided that you could do it all on your own and get back there. And so the lesson to be learned was, there are probably sources that you could call on to help you with something, if you did it in a timely way, that would allow you to excel. Did I draw on all the help that was available to me?
Well, what did they say? Don't be a hero. Don't be a hero. Look at your back. Relax. Settle down. Call somebody. Don't think you know what you're doing. There may be things you don't see. And when you're that far away from your unit, whatever, it's going to be sketchy.
Remember what we said when we were looking at the differences between men and women in the marriage series a while back? That women tend to naturally organize and work together. Men tend to divide and conquer. In other words, they delegate. You go do this, you go do that, you go do that. So they split up. Women all go together. Remember the maze illustration that we used? That when women try to solve a maze problem, they all walk together to every dead end, and then together they finally find their way out. Where men split up, one goes this way, one goes that way, and one goes the other way. And naturally, we're all men, so we think, well, that seems like the logical way to do it.
And a brave learner's wife.
Was reaching the objective genuinely important to me? If so, why? And if not, why did I accept it as a mission to accomplish? Now, there's a great diagnostic question. Maybe more so for adults than for kids, but did this really matter to you? And if it fails, can you still say that it matters to you? And the reason I say it's a great diagnostic question is, have you ever done something not because you believed in the cause, but because you wanted the attention?
Is he playing baseball just because you play baseball? Maybe he's better at basketball.
Well, is he playing baseball because you pressured him into it? Did he accept the mission? Or did you kind of like force the mission on him? And is he playing baseball for the love of the game? Is he playing baseball to impress his parents? Is he playing baseball to impress a girlfriend or a prospective girlfriend. What exactly is the motivation behind your desire to excel? Is it really to achieve that end? Or is there some side motivation that really is your predominant motivation for doing this? And it's, you know, kids typically don't think through all that. Honestly, adults usually don't think through all of that. Because we really don't like what we find when we dig two layers down into our own motivation for doing things. And finally, would answering and addressing each of these issues raised above place me in a better position to succeed in the future? So, what didn't I know that I need to know more of in the future? What skills do I need to practice or improve, and did I take the time to practice? The character and the poise issue, am I ready to do this? Am I comfortable doing it? Incidentally, let's come back to the deer illustration for just a moment. What improves that likelihood that you're going to hit the deer? Yeah, it is. It's doing it again and again and again, and you have to know that, right? And with a deer, it's okay. What's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is you leave the woods unencumbered by the pesky weight of the deer that you'd have to carry out, right? Isn't that good news? What's the worst that happens if you're tasked with public speaking and you're not good at that? And you have to do it again and again and again to get good at it. Now, again, with the perspective of time, we understand, okay, 6 months out, a year out, there's going to be a good outcome. I'll just keep pressing through that. But when you're 10 and you're devastated or traumatized by something more than twice, what do you want to do? Exactly why we're doing this.
That's why I said that, though. We don't, oftentimes, it's really easy for us to kind of just take three or four people's ideas and we don't ask those questions. You know what I mean? Like, you think, you're never going to remember all of these questions when it comes up with your kids. When it comes up, you don't really have it written down step by step by step. How do we deal with this? You know, it's written down, this is what we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this. We're kind of flying by the seat of our pants, and we're hoping that we remember everything that our grandparents and our parents said, but we don't. And we don't even bother picking up the phone to ask them. A lot of times we make decisions for the family, and we don't even pick up the phone and go, Mom, he just did this.
Do you remember what we've said about having dinner table conversations? That if we're going to make this stuff relevant, you're going to go home, you're going to talk about it with your wife, you're going to talk about it with your wife, with your kids in the room. And maybe in the case of this failure thing, you're going to pick a particular time recently when somebody did fail. Maybe the first case study that you're going to use is one of your own or one of your wife's, so that it isn't your kid who's the spotlight shining on your kid. But then gradually you're going to use those same things. And I believe that if you have the conversations enough and you diagnose these things enough with them in the room all doing it together, it will become normal and matter of fact. We could go right to the back page, actually, and say, yeah, we could. Page 8, I guess it is, on yours. Final thoughts. Great dads help their children to process failure. This means separating results from feelings, facts from identity. Great dads will help their children to fully understand the cost of failing, but equip them with the belief and the hope that good and great things are possible. Okay, stop before we read any more. This is our job. No one else is going to help your children understand how to process failure. The message they get in school is going to be ugly. We're going to come back to that. The message they get in school about failure is going to be ugly. If they wait until they get out into the work world, it's going to be intimidating.
It's funny, too, because the message they get about work is different, too. get that sort of like, it's okay, it's all right, everybody gets it.
The message that most people get about everything in the world and in society is a little bit different.
I'm not going to try as hard. Why? I'll get a trophy anyway. Because the guys go commercial, the guys like, whoa, 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 we play hard all year, we beat everybody. Champs. Rips the participation thing off the front and writes champs on the front. Good job, champ. You know what I mean? You, that kid worked hard. He deserves to hear the word champion. Where this one, maybe, didn't. And it was evident. Not that he didn't try. He tried hard. You know, maybe he tried, but he was just like, whatever.
All right. Throttle it down a little. Are you taking off? Okay.
Isn't the overarching theme of these the relationship that we have to be in with our kids, the relationship that we lack with our parents, why we have to learn these things now when we're all older? Because in those relationships, if we're not honest about our failures with our children, we don't let them see us fail. Not that we tell our kids, hey, by the way, your dad's a failure. But maybe in these instances, yeah, I didn't get the result that I was looking for, that I thought I was being led to. If we're missing the overarching theme that the Bible says in all things, do it as if unto the Lord. I'm going to give my best, and that's what I expect from you. Not that you're perfect, but that you're going to put the time in, that you're going to put the effort in, that you're going to try. Now, my kids have seen me pray in front of churches, my prayer is fairly simple. Lord, give me your words or shut my mouth, and I'll open my eyes, and I'll have absolutely nothing to say. And I'm like, oh, crap, he showed up again. Being seeking God first, all of these, I can't fail by definition. Because regardless of the outcome, I've done what God has led me to do. I'm a success regardless of the outcome. But if my kids see that a trophy is the reward, and Paul talks about all runners run a race, but it's only the one who wins who gets the crown. If both of my children run God's race for their life, regardless of what it looks like on the outside, you know, I may be a financial failure in comparison to someone else, but if I look at, did I do what God invited me to do, and then He enabled me to do it, I can't fail.
Let me push back on that a little bit. Because if I'm, and actually that ties right into the big idea. So look at that. We set ourselves up for that. And the main principle for the morning is that failure actually is inevitable. And that all of us, at one time or another, most of us, many times, are going to fail. The key here is to not have a fatal failure. So any failure that is not a fatal failure, we're still alive in order to retool, regear, and move ahead. But until we are able to be at peace with the fact that failure is not a departure from normal, but in most cases is a very real part of normal, in other words, failure is normal. Success is not normal, failure is normal. And yet what most kids learn in the public education system, even in a homeschooling setting, is that success is the normal and expected outcome, and failure is a departure and an unacceptable departure from the normal. Now, Vinny offered some good stuff that I don't want to ignore. So we're going to come back to that in a minute, but John had his hand up, I think.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think the key word you mentioned here is expected. I think if you're expecting failure, it's not going to be so fatal when it happens. You're going to, if you can teach your kids that's a normal, like, you know, we're trying to do this, but we messed up here and here. Let's say there's 10 steps. There's going to be like 1A, 1B, 1C, and then you come back and you, after the failure, you pick up and you get to number 2, and you go off on that. You expect to not go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Once they kind of, you kind of show them that pattern, they'll kind of get that mindset, and it won't be so fatal when something goes wrong. Even if it's really bad, even if you go to 1Z, you know, you still come back to number 2 once you get everything figured out. So I think that helped me a lot. When I was spoken up front of church a couple of times, and a whole bunch of different things in life. What really threw me, I look back on some of them, what really threw me is like, you get up front, the microphone's not working or something, and or like a speech at a wedding one time, the microphone didn't work at all, so I had to speak real loud in front of 200 people. I didn't expect it all, so kind of my mind's racing, and I'm not doing what I originally intended, so it just threw me off. But if I would have expected, like, okay, something's going to go wrong, whether it's the microphone, whether it's, you know, I trip on the way up there, or whatever, but if you just go along with it, I think, you know, it'll help the outcome. You can still do what you intended to do. Just kind of ignore those bumps along the way, or just change something you did to be better next time.
All right. Let me come back to what you said, because we tend to break things down quite naturally. We live in day-to-day experience. God views things on a much broader scale. And so God has a lifetime perspective for what he intends for us to do and how we're going to succeed. But let's face it, in the moment by moment of life, we can feel as if we've not done everything that we should have. We can feel like we failed. Here's the point that goes along with this, that failure is the normal and that success is not the normal. If I believe that success is normal, what am I going to do with my failures? I've got to move because the sun is reflecting off that table horribly. If I believe that success is normal and I fail, what am I going to do with my failures? As opposed to if I believe that failure is a natural part of success. What's that? Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to deny or avoid addressing the failures. Do you realize the courage that it takes if I am schooled to believe that success is the natural and the normal outcome of effort and I fail? What does that make me, first off? It makes me a departure from normal, which makes me what? Abnormal. Now, if I am abnormal, or if failure is abnormal, what am I going to do with my failures? Am I going to want to look at them courageously and boldly, or am I going to try to hide them and tuck them away? What's our natural tendency? Think about the biggest problem you've had in life. Are you anxious and eager to rush toward it and say, bring me more of that problem, I'm excited to deal with it? No, we tend to try to push it out. And here's the thing. The only way that we are going to arrive at success, if failure is a destination along the pathway to success, is to look at the failure, understand it completely, break it down, and move on better for the process. But if we don't do that, then here's what happens. Every day of life is essentially a new lucky string of events. Why? Because I learned nothing from yesterday. If I'm unwilling to learn anything from yesterday's failed attempts, then today is simply a repeat of yesterday and a string of either lucky or unlucky events. In order for me to be on a pathway towards success, I must accept that failure is part of the pathway and debrief myself and look at everything that I've done well or not done well. Did that make sense? Scott?
I'm kind of thinking about, how does a parent teach a child about failure, how they handle failure in the right attitude, with the right optimism to call? And I'm thinking about, like, I like to watch the old Western movies and a lot of old movies. And I see, years ago, kids did things with their parents. They worked with their parents, they did chores with their parents, they did whatever with their parents. There was a lot more family interaction years ago than there is today, as far as quality, not just time and quality. And so many times in those events, something goes wrong. And the kid says, oh, now what? And the parent very calmly says, it's okay. You know, little Bob, this is how we do it. And they fix the problem. So when you look at it that way, a failure isn't monumental. It's just an inconvenience. It's a disappointment that has a resolution. And there's something to learn from. And I think those things that kids learned many years ago are overlooked today because we don't have that problem solved interaction with our kids like they did years ago. Because I think if you attack a problem, call it failure, disappointment, whatever you want to call it, a mishap, with the right attitude, I think as you go through all of life's disappointments, you handle them much better.
Okay, so that brings us back to the point on the final page, which is it's our job to establish this culture of discussion and understanding in the home. Rather than complaining about, and honestly, this is something that we all do. Well, in the old days, we used to, whatever. Right? In the old days, we used to use an outhouse outside the house, and we used to light a whale oil lamp at night to read by, okay? So let's not go back to the old days. The old days, the new days, I don't care what days they are. This is the day when it is up to us to accept responsibility for our families. No, I was not old enough to light a whale oil lamp, so just put your chuckling away.
Dinosaur oil lamp.
Do you understand? It doesn't matter what the setting. We can find a reason to say, well, it's not the same as it used to be. We can't do this. Yes, we can. And it's our job to figure that out. Because remember what's at stake. They're not going to learn this anywhere else. And that's why, remember how we introduced this whole overarching topic. That most of us arrive at adult life and we don't even understand these principles completely. We start to raise kids, and because we still don't understand the principles, we can't teach our kids these principles. So we need to learn the principles for ourselves so that we can teach our kids, so that when they arrive at adulthood, they've got a better footing to stand on. All right, so we can already get to page 2 of the outline. How's that? So the basic interpretation of Lens 1, which is, we'll call it the educational model, and it's one of the first ones that your children are immersed in, and I say, really, immersed in it. And how many hours a day does a kid spend in school? 5, 6, 7, something like that. It's a lot, right? It really is a lot. And so they are immersed in it. Now, here's the overarching lesson that they will probably learn. If I do these things in this order, in this way, I will succeed. And yet they don't always succeed because there's variables. And the education system cannot possibly address all the variables. It can't address the fact that Johnny won't sit still long enough to learn things. And Susie hates Sally, and therefore Susie and Sally are more distracted by how they hate each other and how both of them love Johnny, and only one of them is going to get to have Johnny's attention. There's all these other dynamics that are going on, and so the kids never really get to be these laboratory experiments that the public education system is intended to produce. So then they fail. So what's the message? And they don't fail at everything, but they fail at some things. And they fail in the presence of others who are succeeding. And that's the most damning part of this. See, if we all failed together, how bad would it be? But what's it like when the guy sitting right next to you succeeds while you fail? And so what are the personal and private messages that we take away from this? And I've written a few of them there, but we can certainly add to it. I'm dumb, this is hard, this is stupid. Have you ever heard your kids, your young kids say this? They might not come out and say, I'm dumb, but have you ever heard your kids say, this is stupid? Or some variation of that? Now, do they really know if it's stupid? What do we usually say about something when we can't do it? This is stupid. Yes, it's a very great face-saving thing, right? It really doesn't matter to me. I don't care about this. What are they really saying? And I care desperately about it. And my image and my ego are all tied up in this thing which I can't do, but I can't admit that I can't do it and that it matters deeply to me. So I'm just going to say, this is stupid. What, stupid? Well, yes, we haven't gotten that far yet, Ron. That's because the kids who grow up in that mindset become the managers that lead you at work, okay? Followed by, I hate this and I intend to quit or quit trying the first chance I get. What happens if we don't break that cycle? Just think about that. If we don't break that cycle or help them to view failure in a different way, help them to process their emotions. So failure has a factual component, and failure has an emotional component. We should probably break that down. So the factual component of failure is there was a desired outcome. So the desired outcome usually has some matrix for measurement, and I can either check it off, right? So in school, it's some sort of, I guess today they use ones and twos and threes. Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I went to school, it used to be A's and B's and C's and D's, hence I referenced that the letter grades rather than numerical grades. So there's very clear measurable ways to determine, did I succeed or did I fail? Okay? But what are the emotional ramifications of failure? And how do I deal with that differently? So I might know what to do to improve my outcome. I adjust this part of the formula, I tweak that, I work a little bit harder, I produce a different result, hopefully. But what do I do with the emotions? And what are some of the emotions?
I think you have to learn how to tweak those as well. And one of them starts with your attitude. With anything you're going into, especially if we're talking about failure, if something doesn't go our way, if we don't get the results, 9 times out of 10, our attitude is, as you said, well, this sucks, or this is stupid. You have to learn to adjust, like, no, okay, this, as one quote says, victory is for the simple, while failure is a learning lesson for the wise. So we have to learn from that failure, adjust from whatever happened, and move forward with it.
And I think for children, and remember, children are not little adults. Which is something, honestly, it's so obvious, but we kind of forget that. Sometime back, we introduced the idea that the typical male brain does not actually become fully connected until the time somebody's about 26 years old. And you were shocked at that time, and nothing's changed since. That there's still hardwiring in your brain that's being connected.
2 years ago.
In other words, a typical male or female is not emotionally and intellectually fully connected and mature until a certain time. So we're expecting emotionally immature little humans to respond as emotionally mature, and they're not going to. So how do we help them with that process? See, if you become demoralized, have you ever gone into a tailspin or a funk because of a failure at work? Have you ever been moody and grouchy at home? Have you ever kicked the cat and beat the wife? Well, maybe that's an extreme. All right, have you ever kicked the cat? Do you own a cat to kick? Oh, you kick other people's cats. Good. Okay, so if we, as allegedly mature men, can go into emotional downward spirals because of a season of failure, what's really going on in a kid's life that they're trying to hide? And how do we help them to process that?
Thinking about this, the one thing I wish I would have heard from my dad is that failing won't stop my love for you. I didn't get that until I was 35 and came to salvation. Probably 30 when I came to salvation. But that was one of the first things I latched on to with God. It was understanding that trying is seeking His heart is what keeps my relationship with Him. It's not success or failure. What I'm trying to do. My dad had told me that when I was 8 or 10, I wouldn't have blown out knees now. I wouldn't have broken bones in my hands. I wouldn't have responded so poorly trying to get his attention or to be like him. Then later on in life, trying so hard not to be him that I end up becoming him, lashing out in anger, becoming an alcoholic, doing all the things that I wouldn't have rebelled against. I guess if I had a dad who sat down and had a conversation with me and said, failure is not your identity. And you are my son. And that's what I heard from God.
I hope everybody heard that, because that's an important lesson. And remember what we've said. There are certain things that you and I, as adult men, learn along the way. But we've already started to implant messages in our children before we learned that. Now, you're fortunate. Your children are young. They're still at home. You've got plenty of years to influence them. Suppose you'd learned that lesson 10 years from now. And you had been the father that you would have been had you not learned that lesson. Now, your children are going to carry that with them. So, that was a really good contribution. Okay. Where do we want to go from here? There's a lot here in this. Maybe there's one other thing that we want to look at. So before we get into, or actually we'll call it a comparison.
You say I want to try to teach a child to think, not to be discouraged, but how can I do this differently to make it work?
And sometimes there's a time frame involved. And we just have to be honest about this. And this is part of helping our children to understand the difference between fatal and non-fatal failures. All right, so let's think about some time frame issues. Public education system, private education system, whatever it is, there's a timeline. Let's look at the timeline. It's predictable. You do this, you have this much time to do this, and then we're going to measure your results. Then you have this much more time to do something else, and we're going to measure your results. Now, how are they able to do that? Because they've got years of experience at assessing what the typical child, how long the typical child should take to master this so that they can move on. You with me? It should take X number of weeks to learn this, after which a typical human is going to have mastered this skill, will test them on this, and then they can move on. What's the problem with that? Everybody's very different. But in a public setting, they can't address all that, can they? So what do they have to do? They have to average it out. Okay, so some people are slow and it takes them 10 months to learn this. Some people are very fast and it takes them 2 weeks to learn this. We're going to have to find some average somewhere in the middle. We're going to bore some kids for quite a while because they learned it and ready to move on, and so they don't know what to do and they're a distraction in class. Some of the kids are looking confused at the end of 4 months and still don't get it, but we've got to move on after two. So everything is an average. Do your children understand that going through the process? No, and most of us don't take the time to think that through, which is why we're doing it this morning. You and I are going to be the ones who are going to offer a buffer and an alternative perspective for them. Listen, you're a unique human being, and the way in which you gather information and are able to excel at tasks is going to be distinct and different from everyone else in the classroom. Now, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be any objective measurement standards. We're not saying that that's wrong. And a child needs to know that there, and I haven't forgotten you, John, a child needs to know that there need to be objective standards. How many of you think that there should be months worth of flexibility in when you pay your electric bill? How many of you think that'll work? It probably won't. See, they need to know that there are certain objective standards. I need to meet this thing by this timeline.
That's exactly the point that Ken Robinson makes with the educator. He had his quote there. Schools are just, they're averaging everybody out. They're not looking for, you know, anybody that's up here or down here. They're just, it says it's like a drum factor. And they just push them through. And as a result of that, now you have a lot of kids in college that are reading at an eighth grade level. And they just don't want to take the time. Just take the test. All they're doing is teaching them how to take tests.
Okay, now, I don't want us to now say, well, we're the victims of we and our children are the victims of a public education system. That's not the message to take away from this. The message is, we are the primary people responsible for bringing up our children. So we have to help them understand and interpret the messages that they're getting. That's our job. Another important distinction is that in a public education system, the objectives are all known and understood. In real life, many of the objectives are not understood, and therefore there can't be a reasonable timeline established. Okay, so there's nothing that is new that your children are learning in school. The only way that they can learn it is because someone else has first learned it and is now passing the information on to them. But in real life, there are many situations where what is being attempted has never been attempted before, and therefore there is no timeline for its achievement. The infamous whiteboard did it again. But if you have been weaned on a system that says it should take X amount of time to do this, and at the end of that, I should be successful, and at the end of twice that much time in the real world, you still haven't accomplished anything, what's your tendency going to be?
Not to try.
To give up, to move on. So in the Lens 2 model, the interpretation, which is, where is that? Page 3. And a lot of this will make much more sense if you read through it. I just can't cover this all. I'm sorry. There's just way too much stuff here. In a Lens 2 model, we just embrace failure. We accept that failure is simply the pathway to get to a better result. Let's read this. It's probably the first sentence below interpretation number 2. I haven't yet found the pathway and method to fully accomplish what I've set out to do, but this failed attempt and experience has taught me some additional parts of what I must learn and master before I can succeed in this area. I can't discover all the components of a successful strategy and its implementation until I try various methods and observe the results. How many of you wish there was a formula for marriage? See what I'm saying? But you are a unique individual, married to a unique individual, and therefore the pathway to success in your marriage is going to be different than in many other people's marriages. How long does it take to achieve a successful marriage?
Lifetime.
Well, the answer is you don't know, right? You're working at it yet. Some of you feel you haven't arrived there. Some of you have arrived there. The good news is that's great. The bad news is some of it could start to spiral out of control tomorrow. So the question that I started to ask myself this morning, because I'm still critiquing this material. There's so much of it here, actually. The funny thing is, I've now actually, Scott, started to look at this as somebody else's book, so I'm starting to pick apart my own work and say, no, I'm not sure I agree with that. It's really funny. Anyway, I started to ask myself the question, in this Lens 2 model, what compels people to keep trying hard? If I don't know when I'm going to get there, if I don't know how long it's going to take or how many setbacks I'm going to encounter, or even if success is possible, what compels me to keep trying?
Belief. It's the belief that you're going to get the mark.
And the importance. And that was the component which we came back to in this other page. Yeah, in this single page, if we look at point number 4, failure generally pertains to things which are important, since there's no purpose behind arbitrary and meaningless objectives. So the only things in life that I'm ultimately going to care about succeeding at are things that are really important. But what does that set up for me? A situation in which every time I fail at that, it brings me an incredible amount of pain. If I want something, I'll get right to you. If I want something badly, believe in it passionately, and believe that it is going to be good for other people, and I miss the mark at that, there's pain for me. Because it matters that deeply that I achieve that objective. Okay, when you're done taking care of your phone, do you want to talk now or not?
No, that's the song. Obviously, we have that. Purchase.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
No, I work at a pharmaceutical company. I would think that everybody sitting here would agree that it'd be nice to have a cure or a preventative vaccine for cancer. Right now there is no vaccine that you can just inject like the measles, mumps, and rubella that children get to prevent cancer. Why don't we have a cure for cancer? I mean, all these pharmaceutical companies are trying. None of them of them haven't achieved it yet. So there's a ton of failure, decades of failure. They discovered many things that don't work to cure cancer, but the cause is still great enough to keep thousands of researchers continuously trying to discover the cure for cancer. So I mean, it's maybe an extreme occupational example of failure and dealing with failure, but the process is the same for any type of failure. If that cause, the mission, if it matters enough, it doesn't matter how many times it did work, you're going to continue to work towards making it.
And it's absolutely not extreme, because in many cases in life, people will give their entire lives to something and they'll never see the successful outcome, but without their having sacrificed their life in order to pursue that, we'd be a generation behind.
One of the guys that I listened to, Bob Proctor, he said, you know, the cure for cancer and AIDS and everything else is probably in the graveyard. And they asked him why. He said, because somebody probably had an idea that this could cure cancer, and they were afraid to put it out because of what this gentleman said. Ridicule, peer pressure, so they never acted on it. And it could have been taken care of. So maybe somewhere, at some place in time, somebody had an idea that wouldn't work, but they never approached it, and they never believed in it strongly.
Now, you make an interesting point there, because, and I'm sure maybe some of you are familiar with this, I'm going to get the facts terribly wrong. But some years ago, there was a research team in Australia, ulcers were a problem, and they developed what they thought was a very innovative solution to ulcers. So ulcers, up until that time, had been treated with certain things, and there was a certain medical assumption about what caused ulcers, therefore what would be the treatment necessary. So this team comes up with an altogether different approach and an altogether different theory about what causes ulcers. And as is customary in the medical field, they sort of like vetted this before their peers by publishing this in a particular medical journal. Well, it was not more than a month went by and they were ridiculed profoundly. This is crazy. This is nonsense. And it was a career sinker for them. It was only their own commitment and passion to the fact that they were right that kept them going, but it actually cost them something financially to continue on in this path because they were maligned. In other words, they were the essence of quacks in the medical research field. Well, they kept at it, and sure enough, their theory was right, and it completely displaced the treatment that was in vogue for ulcers. But had they been any lesser people of character and succumbed to the peer pressure, they would have given up and we'd still be being treated with the old methods. Good story. All right, here's another one that we want to look at, I think. Page 4. Now, be careful how you teach your children this. And it's at the bottom of page 4, and it's going to spill over into page 5, and we're not going to read it all now. What I want you to do in the last paragraph of page 4 is write this heading above that. Failure and success are often team efforts.
Above the last paragraph?
Yeah. That way it'll make sense to you when you come back to it. Failure and success are often team efforts. All right, so we're going to use the public education system model for a moment, and we're going to look at this. Who's responsible for your child's success? Who's responsible for their letter or numeric grade? In that system, the child is, right? Now, here's the funny thing. When we go out into the business world, and a particular group of people, a team we'll call it, is assigned a responsibility to solve a particular problem, who answers for the team's failure? It isn't the individual members of the team that answer for the failure, it's the team leader that answers for the failure, right? Now, who answers for the failure in the public education system?
Where do you want to start?
Easy there, Tiger. Well, where is the failure assigned? The student. Isn't it interesting how upside down that is? And it's not as if we say, well, teacher and team together share responsibility, wherein the teacher says, okay, maybe we need to reinvent the teaching method. Instead, the failure rolls downhill. So one of the things that we need to understand is that failure and success are team efforts. Now, who gets the credit when the student gets an A? The student does. But in fact, who should get the credit? The student and the teacher. When students do well, the teacher should share in the credit. When students do poorly, the teacher should share in the credit. That's not the lesson they learn. And yet, incidentally, we can see examples where there are innovative teachers that do a phenomenal job, even in the worst of circumstances, where there's poor schools, where they don't have enough resources, and yet somehow creative teachers find a way to solve problems and inspire students, even in the worst of circumstances. And they should be singled out and really receive some praise for that. All right, we've covered the when time matters part, which doesn't have a heading, but let me give you that heading, even though it's not on there. Page 5, partway down, seen through a lens once, the calendar is a deciding factor in a student's final grade. Just right above that, when time matters, I'm going to let you read that part on your own. And then we're going to turn over to... we'll start at the bottom of page 5. And at the bottom of page 5, I want you to write above that, facing the facts. Now let's look at some useful questions which can help a person, young or old, to understand and evaluate a performance. Question number 1, did I reach the goal? That's a yes or no question. Did I reach the goal on time? And let's describe what on time is. On time is before it's too late. So we'll take your example of cancer. Did I reach the goal on time? Well, not for some people, but perhaps for others. And again, this is real life and death stuff that you introduced there. Did I reach the goal of a cure for cancer on time? Well, no, not for the guy that we buried yesterday. But I might for the guy that we won't bury next year if we keep pressing into it.
I think that's really interesting how I look at it.
You can say older. You can go ahead and use that word.
Life used to be, very quick and stuff, and I would tend to look at things in a very short span of time, and I would only think of things only to my life's end. The world just stops after I die. You know what I mean? But it doesn't. And I guess with having kids, you just realize there's so many things that you can write or say and do that can impact tons of people that you have no idea. I was reading the C.S. Lewis book, and I loved it. And I was like, wow, I'm so thankful that, this guy decided to write all this stuff down for some who knows what, like me, that he had no idea the impact of my life, and he did. And, with parents, and I'm thinking, I'm starting to identify some things in my families that have been, reproduced and passed down that aren't just biological, that just all these things. And it's like, that's in my court to do that for my kids. And it's just a really interesting way to look at that. Life is way bigger than you, and your actions are way bigger than my actions affect, not sounding narcissistic, but me speaking or you speaking, or it impacts people in ways that we'll never know. It's really interesting to see that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's why we say repeatedly that in every generation, you as a father can be a cycle breaker or a cycle initiator. If there is bad stuff that has been passed down generationally in the way of thinking and understanding, you can be the father who breaks that cycle, so that your kids go out into the world different. And you can also be a cycle initiator, wherein you start to infuse into your children things where they go out. And if you have two children, how many people are they going to come in contact with in a lifetime? I mean, we say it repeatedly, but it sounds so trite and so cliche. If you want to make a real difference in the world, parent well. And doesn't that sound so cheesy? You think of all the world's problems, but all the world's problems somehow involve people, don't they? So if people were parented differently when they were little people, would the world look differently? And the answer is, of course. Okay, question number three, the final one. So we've looked at, did I reach the goal? Did I reach the goal on time? Did I use a legitimate process in attempting to get there? Now this is where it really starts to get dicey. Is it possible for me to succeed at something and in the process fail at something more important? It is, isn't it? Okay, so a series of questions. Sometimes we discover that the goal was wrong. It was either not the best goal or not the right goal for me, or not a real goal, but rather some sort of a fuzzy and poorly expressed dream. So we have to have the courage to say, was this even achievable? Huh? Do you remember what you wanted to be when you were 12?
Retired.
Already at that age, retired? Okay. Does nobody have a serious answer, or you just did anybody want to be something crazy? Okay, now obviously some people want to be astronauts and they actually grow up to be that. But most people don't. That's a serious answer, isn't it? Wow. Let's turn over to Matthew 16. We have used this text before. We'll probably want to look at it again. And this is one of these things where when you're a child, you don't have the perspective to appreciate what we're about to look at. But as an adult, hopefully, if you've gotten into your 30s or your 40s, and you'll get there, so just be patient, you'll acquire the perspective that's going to allow you to appreciate this. We'll start at verse 24 of 16. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what would a man give in return for his soul?" And so, like we discussed the other week, Jesus is describing this hypothetical situation where a person could get the whole world, but let's think about it in more practical terms. Your children will have childish goals. That's inevitable. Your children will have goals that will have consequences. You see, everything that you and I want will have a consequence for its attainment. Now, there's a good consequence. I'll get whatever it is that I wanted. But there's the side effects of getting it, which means I'm going to lose something else. In other words, I have to give up something for everything that I get. What am I going to give up to get the thing that I want? Now, when you're 10 or 12 or 16, you don't really have the lifetime perspective to understand what it's going to cost you to get what you want or where you'll get, where it will take you. I think it is helpful for us as parents to at least be able to unpack with our children what the long-term ramifications of them getting what they want might be. They're going to rebel. They're going to resist it. They're going to tell you that that's silly and that's not going to happen to them. We know that, right? How do we know that? Because that's exactly what we did when our parents suggested that that might happen to us if we wanted that. But it doesn't negate the value of telling them that. So think about some of the things that you have wanted in your past, since you were a mature adult. Have you wanted anything since you were 21 that later on, after you got it, you realized that the price of obtaining it was higher and the cost of something else in your life was greater than you ever anticipated it would be? Yeah. And so it is possible to succeed at one thing and in the process fail at something that is even greater. Let me just make sure that there's nothing else here that we want to assess before we move on. Okay. I think we covered it on page 7. You don't need to turn over there. We're actually pretty much out of time. But I think this is an interesting thing. I believe there are many people who are credited with possibly saying it. Richard Branson is particularly fond of saying this and repeatedly saying this. So no matter what else you think of Richard Branson, you have to admit he's a pretty successful serial entrepreneur. Everybody know who Richard Branson is? And he says that, among other things that he has learned in life, it's best to fail fast, fail often, fail small, get it over with, because if you know that your success is on the other side of all your failures, the sooner you get done with all the failures, the quicker you'll arrive at your success. So I think we'll close with that.